Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Down the Pit. We're super excited to host our guest today, violinist Charles Yang. I'm just going to use a quote that describes him quite well. This is from the Texas Observer, which says, "Mr. Yang is a true crossover artist, a pioneer who can hop between classical and popular music and bring fresh ideas to fans of both genres. Rather than maintaining an insular focus and simply assuming that an audience for classical music will always exist, he wants to actively create that audience, to persuade and seduce others into enjoying a type of music as passionately as he does." Charles Yang is one of a kind, and we're so happy to have him today. In part one of this interview, we will talk about his upbringing, how he deals with nerves on stage, writing the score for a movie, touring with his band Time for Three, composing, singing, and so much more.
We would like to thank our corporate sponsor, US Pave. For any of your commercial or residential paving needs, please visit uspave.com. US Pave, the national paving company. Hi, Charles. I've heard so much about you. I'm really excited that I finally get to talk to you. I have an important question for you. You grew up in Texas. Is it fair to say that you are into cowboy boots, hats, square dancing, and barbecue?
Oh, man, you got me, Ian. That's,
I nailed it?
Yeah. For the people that are hearing my voice and don't know who I am, that's the pure depiction of me. I think, you know, when I go on stage, you're like, oh, that's that cowboy kid from Texas. Oh, yeah, that's the guy. I mean, there's truth to that. You know, there's truth to that. I grew up in Austin, Texas. You know, a lot of my friends are that cowboy hat. I don't know about the square dancing, but definitely barbecue. Mm-hmm. And we're all chill, laid-back people. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I am that kind of little Asian cowboy in me.
So now that we get that squared away, what was life for Young Charles?
Yeah, Young Charles is that's a great rapper name, if I ever go that direction. Born and raised in Austin, Texas. My mom is a violinist as well. She went to the Shanghai Conservatory. She was, you know, playing Western music during the Cultural Revolution in China. So that was pretty extreme of her, you know, to be doing that. It was kind of risky. But I'm so grateful that her and my dad came to Austin, Texas, had me, and forced me to play violin. You know, I forced. At the age of three, you know, they put a violin in my hands. And I don't remember not ever playing violin. Like, in my whole life, I don't remember not knowing the violin, but I do remember just hating practicing and just hating the sounds that were coming out of this little baby violin. And, you know, my mom teaches as well, and her students were sounding good. And I'm in the other room just kind of squeaking away and just saying, well, I'm only doing this because my mom asked me to do that, you know, and they're pretty, you know, I'm an only child, and they just kind of put everything on me.
Was she your first teacher?
My first teacher. She was my first teacher, and my dad's not a musician, but he was kind of like a teacher, too. He would just sit there, and, you know, you heard of tiger moms, but he was like a dragon dad and just was there watching me practice all the time. I would cry. I would just be like, why am I doing this, you know? Up until, like, I don't know, the age of, like, 8 or 9, I just really was practicing for my parents. Yeah, miserable. My parents, you know, my friends were all out playing soccer and you know, having a good time, and I'm at home just crying, playing violin.
Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Yeah, I played that for 7 years. I mean, never, haven't really mastered the B section yet. but it wasn't until I went to Interlaken. I think I was age 9 or 10 for the first time. My parents took me to Interlaken, and I met other people like me. Mm-hmm. You know, I went in Texas, I went to public school. None of my friends really played. They played sports. And didn't really know anyone else that did what I was doing or practiced like I did. And went to Interlaken, met everybody there that were like me, and I fell in love with music. Played chamber music for the first time. played some concertos for the first time. Yeah, that's when I really fell in love with playing the violin. I was practicing for myself, no longer for my parents, you know.
So Austin, Texas is on my bucket list of places to go.
You gotta go.
I know, everyone's saying that. Would you say that Austin has the best live music in the country?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, we're known for our live music. You know, growing up, it was weird to hear that, though, because classical music was, we have a classical, you know, we have a symphony, we have some chamber music societies there, but it wasn't what people were talking about when they said live music capital of the world, you know? They were talking about Antones, they were talking about Red-Eyed Fly, and all these clubs downtown, and all the legends like Stevie Ray Vaughan, all of them coming through there. So for me, hearing live music capital of the world, I was like, the symphony plays not that many shows a year, and you know, it didn't really make sense to me. My parents, you know, coming from China, their whole life was just classical music, didn't really know much of Western pop music. So I didn't really know who the Beatles or Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin, you know, I didn't know who they were growing up. I remember at school, my friends, I think they got like a new Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears album. And they're like, did you check out this new CD? And I said, no, but I just got a new Pinkus Zukerman CD. They're like, who? And that blew my mind. I was like, who? How do you not know Pinkus Zukerman? In their world, they weren't accustomed to that. So that was also a thing that I really pushed for at school, was just trying to get my friends into what I did and the music I listened to. So yeah, by the end of it, Pinkus Zukerman was someone that they knew, which I'm pretty proud of.
That's awesome. How did you get into music? I mean, you said interlocking your family, but what really made you who you are now?
Definitely think it's a combination of things. Having strict parents making me practice, setting my foundation, which I'm so grateful for, but also exploring, being the rebellious only child in my family. I was not a good kid, you know? I was not a good son. I would argue. I would go out with my friends. And, you know, they would show me Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, the Who, all this classic rock that I fell in love with. And I remember specifically, my friends had a band called Peach Fuzz that I would go and play with sometimes. They asked me to come over to jam. You know, they had picked up their instruments maybe a couple months before or maybe a year. But they were playing all these rock songs. And yeah, they asked me to come over and jam, play the blues. And I said, do you have music for me? Do you have any sheet music for me? And they said, no, we don't read music. Here's the blues pentatonic scale. This is what we're playing the blues. They taught me the 12-bar blues. And that opened my whole world up to just kind of what I do today even. You know, just I learned about the blues. I learned about improvising and just fell in love with classic rock and all kinds of music, and just seeing how the connection between scales are what I've been playing with my whole life. You know, I've been crying playing a G major scale for years and years before that, but I didn't know the function of it. And then when they took away a couple notes on a pentatonic scale, I just was like, whoa, I know this. And it just kind of opened my eyes to music in general, not just classical music. And then I understood, oh, live music capital of the world, Austin, Texas, it makes sense. There's people playing everywhere. There's people exploring their art form, just not my art form that I knew at that time. So I think that was when I started really, you know, it was when I stopped practicing for my parents, but for myself instead. And also this particular instance, you know, I kind of learned so much from it. And that became my motto in being a musician.
And why did you decide to go to Juilliard after having experienced all that?
Well, I mean, a couple things led up to Juilliard. Sami, we have this connection, but I was telling you the other night, I had read Dorothy DeLay's book. My mom had bought Dorothy DeLay's book that I read religiously after Interlock. And I was like, oh, this legendary teacher, all these violinists that I listen to are all in this book, and I would read it. And at that point, I wanted to go to Aspen, and I auditioned for her studio, for Dorothy DeLay's studio, and I got in. But that was the year I got there, and she was ill, didn't go, never got to study with her. But I remember the audition process. When I got there, they had to place me with one of her many, many assistants.
Yeah.
And they all sat there at a table. I didn't know any of them. I just played, and I got matched with Kurt Sassmannshaus, who was my first real teacher after my mom, who I studied with for many, many years. And he, you know, was such a great teacher and entrepreneur. He was always looking for ways to, first of all, teach, be a great teacher, but also how do I get my students into the performance space? And he had a chamber orchestra that we all got to play with. He had all these opportunities to perform, and I'm so grateful for that. But yeah, also at that time, internet was starting to happen, and he had this online teaching thing called Violin Masterclass. There's like a really nerdy video of me playing Sibelius, and it's terrible. But it's still up there. But I'm so grateful for those times because, I got to meet all these other musicians from all around the world that studied with him as well, like Tessa, John Myron, a lot of friends that I still have today. Every single student that comes through Kurt is weird, has like this open-mindedness of doing something a little different, you know? If you look at Tessa, you know, this is Tessa Lark I'm talking about. She's an incredible violinist, but also an amazing fiddler.
Yep.
And can just cross over into many, many different genres. So, you know, and John Myron is also in a group playing different things, and me as well doing different things. I think it was just that kind of entrepreneur mindset of just not just being a traditional classical musician that kind of also shaped where I'm at now. So yeah, Kurt was a big part of my life. I also studied with Paul Kanner there, who was also amazing. But in Austin, I studied with Brian Lewis. He came, this young guy, he was the new teacher at University of Texas. Yeah, my parents gave me lessons with him, and he was this young dude that I usually had like a teacher, you know, a little older than me, but he was a young guy and had this young energy, and that also kind of shaped that kind of, oh, I'm scared of my teacher vibe, but more like, I want to learn from you.
Your mom allowed that?
I wouldn't say she allowed that, but I was a bad kid. I was not the exact way she wanted me to be. But yeah. Glenn Dictorow came. I remember Glenn Dictorow came and gave me a masterclass in University of Texas. And I was a kid in high school, and I played in his masterclass. And he said, you should come audition for me at Juilliard. And that's what I did. And I ended up there, and I've stayed in New York ever since.
So while you were at Juilliard, you were able to become involved with the band Time for Three. Can you tell our audience what you guys do?
That was actually after Juilliard. You know, Time for Three, that's the group I play in now, that consists of Renan Meyer and Nick Kendall. And, you know, they're pioneers in our world of kind of like Sybarite 5. You know, you guys have paved a way into not just thinking of classical music being all the masters that we play, you know, but opening it up to different kinds of genres. And I was doing that in school. You know, I was that weird kid at Juilliard, just kind of like I had an electric violin and I was singing and I'm jamming with some jazz kids, you know. I kind of built a little bit of a reputation in doing that. You know, Time for Three was looking for a member after being around for so long. You know, they were established and, you know, I knew who they were. They were in that same lane as well. They gave me a call. Nick gave me a call and I went over and it was just kind of, it was meant to be. You know, I met these two musicians who lived a whole generation before me of doing this kind of stuff. And they were looking for that kind of, that same energy. And we just kind of linked and clicked, and the rest is history. Now we're exploring different things, you know.
How do you come up with repertoire? Like, you consider yourself a garage band, and do you just improvise?
Is that still on the bio?
I don't know. I read it somewhere.
Oh man, I think the old bio said that Time for Three was a, you know, it's like a classically trained garage band, which has its truth to it. You know, the first time I met them, it was that. It was kind of like that meeting I had with my friends in high school when they taught me the blues, where we just went and we jammed. We just, you know, I went there, no repertoire. I just went and jammed. I played some of their tunes. They played some of mine. But nothing written out like that was just play this. It was something, and still, like to this day, where there's no show that's the same because there's a lot of improv involved with our set. So repertoire is hard. It's hard to say for us because we're constantly writing, we're constantly arranging, but we also are lucky enough to, you know, have concertos by some of the top composers of today's time write for us, like Jennifer Higdon. We have a Kevin Putz concerto. We were supposed to premiere last year, but that we're recording soon. And we're just lucky to kind of live in all these different worlds. And that kind of dictates our repertoire rather than the other way.
And when you say you write your own music, do you get together, take out your instruments, start playing things? Or does everyone have a role that's a different role? I know Renan has done a lot of composing, so have you.
Yeah, we all write. And that was one thing we talked about at my first meeting with them. It's I told the guys, like, what I want to do is I have all these tools that if I was to join, I'd love to write. I'd love to explore different sounds, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're gracious enough to accommodate that. That's what we're all doing now. I sing. The guys didn't before that. Now we're all singing, three-part harmony. It's just so fun to explore and not think, oh, we're kind of limited to two violins and a bass, because that's already limiting, you know. Yeah. That's already limiting by itself. So now we're essentially with our voices, we have six different voices we can work with. You know, the writing process is different. Sometimes I'll bring something to the table, Renan will bring something to the table, Nick will bring something to the table, and then we just kind of go from there. We do collaborate with songwriters as well. We talk about another world. We are also lucky enough to go to, like, Nashville and write with songwriters like Liz Rose, who is like the Jen Higdon in our world. Mm-hmm. And we wrote a couple tunes that we put out. It's a fun process. Doesn't even mean we pick up our violins and bass. Sometimes it comes on the piano and guitar, and then it branches out from there.
So what's your favorite type of genre to perform? You've played bluegrass to jazz to hip-hop and done a lot of different covers. So what would you say is your number one on your list?
It's so hard, right, to mm-hmm. be a group that kind of lives in so many worlds, to kind of find its own voice. Because we do so many things, it can be a little confusing, you know, the covers, concertos, and now with the vocals, our singer-songwriter stuff. But we've really kind of lived in that singer-songwriter world since I joined. I'm really hoping we can keep that up. I mean, that's when you have a new member in the group, the DNA changes, you know? So now the DNA has changed, and this is how we're approaching music while also, you know, doing the other stuff. I would say writing songs, writing our own stuff, and playing our own stuff, that's really what I strive to continue doing with the group, you know?
That's great.
So during the pandemic, a lot of musicians started creating videos and experimenting, but yeah. You've done that for a long time when not many people were doing that. What inspired you to start making them when you did and using that creative outlet?
Yeah. First of all, this pandemic, it's been tough on everybody. It's mm-hmm. been really tough mm-hmm. on everybody, but there are silver linings, and that to me, for our industry, for the classical music industry, is just seeing so many musicians, professional and students, pick up a computer and a recording device for the first time. I wish that this was a norm. At the time when I was doing my videos, YouTube was just coming up. It was kind of popular, and you know, I had always been curious about recording myself and and just writing different weird arrangements and writing stuff and then recording it. And I just remember being curious about it, so I went and picked up a recording device, a camcorder, and I set it up in a Juilliard practice room and recorded my first video, and I put it on YouTube, and it kind of went a little viral for that time, you know. Mm-hmm. Suddenly everybody at Juilliard had seen it, and people, my friends at home had seen it. All these worlds were seeing it. Not only, it's not just in a concert hall, but that outlet was there. That pushed me to keep doing that. It pushed me to say, oh, this is okay. I mean, my curiosity wasn't just for fun, but it actually landed on people. So mm-hmm. I'm just so happy that people are getting their voices out there, you know, because right now in our time, it's not just about finishing school and waiting for the phone to ring or waiting for a manager. It's how to be proactive during that time so that you can have those tools later once you're ready for a career, you know?
For sure.
So Charles, the Boston Globe claims that you are a rock star. Do you live like one?
No, well, that's for off-air talk only. Look.
Nothing juicy?
It's pretty juicy. I live a lucky life.
He's
I
a really rebel.
I'm a rebel. My parents still say, no, don't drink too much. It's a fun life. We live in a pretty pressure-sensitive world, our industry. When I'm playing with Time for Three or when I'm playing my own stuff, I kind of just I go to that kind of mentality of when I played in a rock band back in high school. And it is freeing in a way. It really is freeing. Before that, just being nervous all the time. I mean, nerves are good. I still get nervous, but it's in a different way. It's more in an exciting way rather than a life or death situation on stage. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you know, I'm lucky that I can live a life musically in many genres, but also socially. I have many friends from all over the place. Boston Globe, I hope I'm doing you justice.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you're still surviving in New York, the city that never sleeps, you know, and the fact that you're still alive.
That is true. I think we're all rock stars here. We're all here.
But you said something that I wanted to touch on. You said you get nervous during concerts. What do you do to combat that?
Oh, man. I mean, nerves happen with everybody. I've always kind of been a little nervous when it comes to standard rep, because in my mind, it was always like, oh, this is a piece that millions of people know. Mm-hmm. People in the audience know this piece. And my fellow peers are all watching me. That's the kind of thing that always circles in my head.
And judging.
Still to this, yeah, and still to this day, it happens. But that means you care, you know, right? You care about your product, and you want the people you respect to also care about it. So it's not a bad thing. You know, I suffered through a bit of like jitters, like the jitters wouldn't go away for a bit. So, you know, it's not an embarrassing thing to talk about, but yeah, I used beta blockers for a bit.
Bananas.
Yeah. Bananas kind of, they just kind of made my throat dry.
So interesting. Okay.
Yeah. But no, bananas work for sure. But the beta blockers was like magic. Before a show, I'd use beta blockers and, oh, suddenly it's gone. But I lost some of that spark. Mm-hmm. So I kind of weaned off of that, which was really tough to do because, you know, once you rely on that to perform with, it's like going on stage without clothes, you know. But I'm happy to say I'm off of it. I still get them here and there, but you just fight through it, you know. Mm-hmm. Once you get in that zone, those first couple moments, it's so relieving to see so many huge stars in our industry also feel the same way. Yep. Be nervous on stage or have the jitters. And it's just like, it's a natural thing that happens to everybody. Now I just switch on that mentality of, I'm just here to play a rock concert.
Do you chew gum?
Let's talk about that. Maybe that's my beta blocker now, but, that's my thing. I chew gum on stage. I don't chew it on stage. Maybe during the tooties, maybe a couple chews.
What kind of gum are we talking about? Spearmint, fruit, what certain type of fruit you like?
I need something a little spicy.
Cinnamon. Spicy, gotcha.
Yeah, a little
cinnamon?
A little dentine ice action. Yeah,
it's nice.
Spearmint,
nice.
Maybe that red one, whatever you call it. Yeah, cinnamon. Something spicy to keep me awake, keep alive on stage, you know? And I tuck it. I tuck it right under my gum, and that's my ritual going on stage.
That's what makes your voice so unique, is that gum.
yeah. It's the spearmint that you're actually smelling. It's not even hearing. You know, you're blown away by the
That's quite a talent
smell.
To be able to sing with a piece of chewing gum in your mouth.
It's not smart. It's not great. It's not great technique for anything. But I do it, and I sometimes I do have it, and I'm singing a high passage. And I feel, oh, here's when my gum is going to pop straight out of my mouth into someone's face.
Or choke you.
Or choke me. Yeah. No. I'm talented in that way. I've already learned how to use the gum without that. But hopefully it'll never fly out of my mouth. But I always feel that way.
Living on the edge, Charles.
Everyone has their thing. I remember one time I played, it was with Time for Three, and we played with the symphony. And we had a VIP thing, and a lady came up to me and was like, I saw you chewing gum on stage. You know, that was very interesting. Like, why do you do that? And I said, well, it's kind of my ritual that I do on stage. And he's like, well, you should consider not doing it. And I haven't listened to her. I didn't listen to her. I should.
You should say, lady, it's better than tobacco.
That's right. Chewing tobacco on stage. That's a different level. Hold on, I got to spit.
Since we're talking about a potential blooper, have you had one on stage?
Oh, absolutely. I think everyone's had bloopers on stage. And that's also what kind of fuels the anxiety, right? I mean, I remember a time, I don't know, I was 14 or something, and I was playing Beethoven Violin Concerto. And I remember the first B section, I played D major instead of D minor and just stopped. Or no, I didn't stop playing. I played like an open E string for like 5 seconds, which is a long time to play an open E string.
Yeah.
In a key that you're just, why? That's not fitting really well. That was scarring for me. I still think about this time. That time.
That's talent, man. Don't you shouldn't be scarred
you're right,
by that.
You're right. No, we all learned the open E string. That's a fundamental thing. I was improvising. But these kind of bloopers on stage kind of also strengthen you in a way, you know, because I remember once I had that blip, or any time I have any blip, in my mind, I'm like, okay, well, there's nothing left to lose. And then I just go for it. And that's when you're in the zone. And that's that feeling that I want to channel every time I'm on stage, just thinking that, oh, there's nothing to lose here. Let's just play. But yeah, we all share that. Bloopers.
Yeah, that reminds me of the one that I had playing at my Yale University graduation recital. I played the Bach C major fugue.
Oh, the hardest.
Which lasted close to 30 minutes because I kept looping.
Oh, yeah, I was there.
Oh,
that was painful.
It's an interpretation, man. That was your interpretation.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I didn't like the first time. Let me do it all over again.
No.
And yeah, I think I went through it 3 times. And when I arrived to that spot, I just made up some chords and I ended.
That's the way to do it.
But then I had 2 more movements to go.
Right. Oh, man. That's brave of you to do that. I've never performed that. But I can tell you, the chaconne, there's been a couple times in the chaconne where I've just like, again, on other things, you can kind of improvise, you know, but in Bach, you can just get in a loop, like you're saying, and just keep going and extend that piece for many, many minutes. That's great, man.
So, Charles, do you have a favorite album that you've recorded? Or are you like Tom Brady? Like, once you get your ring, your favorite ring is the next one?
I don't want to say what I feel about Tom Brady on this.
Oh, please don't. We're super huge fans here.
No.
Okay, good.
He's talking for himself. I would love to hear it.
Yeah, there's no one like Tom Brady. No, but I'm definitely not like Tom Brady.
You have a favorite album?
No. Well, I say this because I don't have an album. Even with TF3. You know, we have just been putting out singles. Mm-hmm. We haven't put out a full album. The only, I guess, album, we recorded a movie soundtrack during the pandemic. We scored a Robin Wright's film, Land. That was awesome. You know, that was, first of all, that was all done in our home studios and put together on a feature film. You know, that was at Sundance and in theaters. And we just had all the, you know, all the colors to work with. She gave us pretty free creativity to work on this. But that was really special. We were all in different places and we all kind of put our own stems, like our own tracks, onto Dropbox. People were down to that. But that process was a lot of fun. I want to do more of that. But to the Tom Brady thing, I don't think of something, you know, recorded down as just like, oh, finally I got it out there. No, I think once I do that, I want to get the next thing. You know, I want to put something else out. Just stay curious, you know.
Since you talked about the soundtrack, how is that process? Do they send you the images and then they tell you, okay, we need something of a certain amount of time to cover this place? Or how does that work for someone like me that doesn't know?
Yeah, it was our first film as well. Mm-hmm. So we were just as in the dark. We were actually surprised that we got asked to do such a big thing. Our first score would be for a feature film for Robin Wright's debut directorial feature film, which was a big deal for us, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it literally started by, you know, Robin came to a show of ours in New York City and fell in love with our music and said, I need you guys for the film. And we said, we've never done this before. She said, I don't care. so it was us and Ben Solee, who's an incredible artist as well, cellist and composer. And we just got together, and he had experience having done commercials and also TV shows and documentaries and stuff like that. But we had no idea. Mm-hmm. So it started with them sending a draft of the cuts they had edited together with some temp music, some which included Time for Three in it. And they said, this is the vibe we're looking for. And then we went from there. But again, the pandemic happened. So mm-hmm. it was new for everybody. We were supposed to be in a studio together, you know, with Robin, playing things until she was like, I like this. But we couldn't. So we did everything online. So it was new for them. It was new for us. And that kind of process led to something really, really magical. And we didn't feel any huge pressure of like, oh, we've never done this before. But that was a fun experience. So, yeah, they sent us a rough. We put stuff on there. And then you do scenes. You go from scene to scene mm-hmm. of music. And we would just write for all those scenes. And it was so cool to see the final thing put together. You know.
That's awesome.
Did you cry?
I'm not a crier, right?
You're not a crier.
off screen, I'm a crier. But yeah. Okay. All right. I shed a tear. Fine.
All right. Good.
Where can people find this film?
I don't know anymore. I don't know if it's still in theaters, but I think it is streaming on some platforms that you can purchase.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, Charles, we're going to move on to our first espresso. This Woo! Is a word association game, and we're just looking for instant answers. The first words that come to your mind. Are you ready, Charles?
Okay.
Do you need some cinnamon gum?
Oh, you're right. I'm getting a little nervous.
No, don't get nervous. No.
That's bad for the podcast, no. I just hope I don't drop any F-bombs.
That's all right. Sami can
bleep it.
Yeah. Okay. Favorite instrument beside yours?
Cello.
Favorite food?
Chinese.
Favorite restaurant?
Man, there's so many good restaurants.
You're not going to do a barbecue one?
That's what I was going to say. I think La Barbecue in Austin.
Favorite chamber music group?
Danish String Quartet.
Favorite jazz artist?
Brad Meldow, off the top of my head.
Favorite cartoon when you were a kid?
Peanuts.
Favorite violinist beside yourself?
Sami.
He paid you. Favorite concerto?
Brahms.
Favorite composer, alive or not?
The OG, Bach.
Favorite violin maker?
I think the Amati family.
Favorite TV series?
I've been obsessed with this show on Netflix called Dark.
Favorite movie?
Eternal Sunshine.
Favorite sport?
Basketball.
Favorite city in the U.S.?
I'd have to say Austin, Texas.
Favorite hobby?
Skateboarding.
Favorite pet?
Dog.
Favorite country to visit?
I love Germany.
Favorite podcast?
Down the Pit. You both paid me to say that one.
We did. Favorite cocktail?
Gin and soda.
Favorite actress?
Natalie Portman.
Favorite pop singer?
David Bowie.
And last but not least, a useless talent you have.
I'm very double jointed, and I can pop my fingers out of their sockets.
Cool.
That's a weird thing.
I'm double jointed too, so.
Okay, we can double joint together, man.
You play the violin and double joint together.
Oh, it's the I don't know with you, Sami, but my fingers, especially my fourth finger, pops mm-hmm. every time I use it.
Oh wow! Yeah, the fourth finger is my least double jointed.
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-oh! Like, sounds like fighting words here.
Yeah. What are you trying to say, man? You're saying. My fourth finger is lesser than yours, bro?
Yeah.
Catch these hands, bro. Catch these hands. No, I remember...
I still don't like to use it.
No, no one likes to use that fourth finger, except for, Anne Sophie Mutter, who's got that perfect fourth finger. But my left hand is naturally out of its socket, like it protrudes out, which I remember all my teachers just being like, relax your thumb. Relax your thumb. I'm like, it is relaxed. And I never knew. I always thought maybe it's not relaxed, but I never knew until later. I just looked at both hands. I'm like, oh, that's how my thumb should look like with my right hand. Does look fine and relaxed.
So, Charles, what has been the breaking moment of your career? or is there one?
I don't really know about breaking moment. I don't really know about or believe there are these kind of breaks anymore, at least, you know? I think in today's time, it's just a cumulative things that happen within your career that lead to the next thing. So for me, I think about all the times that I went out and was playing with this rock band as a kid, and my mom being like, don't stop, don't waste your time on that, you should be practicing. That led to, I mean, literally is what I do today too, you know? I think about the times that I got to play with amazing orchestras thinking, oh, that's my break. But no, it's just one led to the other, and that orchestra led to the other, and things just kind of happened, but it wasn't like career is made. You know, and even now with Time for Three, you know, we're very comfortable and we're very lucky to be touring the world. I wouldn't say any of us would say that we've made it. And the day we do say that, I think we'd all lose interest in the group. Mm-hmm. You know, we always are striving for what's next, or how do we continue to stay curious. So I don't think there was a breaking point. There's many, many small moments that I cherish and I'm very grateful for that led to where I'm at today.
Just out of curiosity, which one was that first video you did in a practice room?
That was Billie Jean. That was Michael Jackson's Billie Jean.
Nice.
Yeah. And that kind of was a fun feeling, a different feeling. Mm-hmm. But it was just I put it out, and the next day, it had just kind of took off. And everybody was sharing it, and it was a weird feeling. That viral feeling is really weird.
Were you dancing to it also, or no?
No, I don't listen. I don't go back and listen to them. There's like a part of me that's like, I know all the things that are like, it's just yucky, you know, just watching myself do something. But no, I don't dance to that at all.
I don't know about you, but I think it's a perfect time to listen to this version of Charlie Yang's Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. And with it, we say goodbye until next week, when we will have the second part of this awesome interview.
She told me her name was Billie Jean, and she calls herself